I guess one of the first things I'll mention is that being at the end of the meeting, very close to the end of the meeting, means I have less to say because so many people have said things better than I can. And so hopefully that means I'll stick to my 15 minutes. In terms of what I'm going to try and cover today, it's very much a practical approach to troubleshooting problems in zoos. And as a rule, when I think about animal welfare, I try to think very positively. And addressing animal welfare problems for me is sort of a bit of a negative approach to animal welfare. But working within a zoo, it's something which frequently, as a researcher in a zoo, people will come to our department and say, there's this, can you come fix it? Well, this is going on, we don't know why. And so this is very much a sort of an overview of how systematically you can approach some of those welfare issues. So it's probably not the ideal way. You want to make sure you don't have the issues to start with. But if you come across issues, these are some of the ways that you can go about mitigating them. So as has been said, lots by everybody, which is good. In terms of thinking about animal welfare, we can think about the mind, body, and nature approach, which has been mentioned just in the two talks before me that set the scene very nicely. But one of the things within zoos is we're not necessarily all blessed with the same scientific technologies or staff, and therefore frequently we have a pragmatic approach, which is predominantly using behavioral indices because those are the types of things that our keepers can note on a daily basis. Don't necessarily require the collection of biological materials, don't require the expense or the fancy labs, and so a lot can be done just with behavior. So even though we are very interested in all the different types of parameters you can collect, sometimes you can go a long way with a pragmatic approach of using behavior. The other thing I want to draw upon is the reason that this presentation, this whole little shoot in my brain happened, was to address the biases that we all approach animal welfare with. And much as we all know that animal welfare is a holistic issue, it affects the mind, body, and nature, that we need to integrate, we all need to chat, and we all need to approach these problems together, we can't help but approach them with the background that we come with. So the vets at work, they will come and they will think about the health first. The keepers will think that there's a housing and husbandry issue. Me, as predominantly a behavioural researcher, will think, it's a social composition. Social composition has had an impact. There's some behaviour which is underlying this research, this animal welfare issue. And so what tends to happen is, depending on the hierarchy within your zoo, depending on how things are organised, you can frequently try to solve an animal welfare problem following one of those biases, because that's the lead person who's in charge. Now, the problem with following a bias and saying it out loud and saying it to a group of people who are all into animal welfare and shaking their heads thinking, yeah, we'd never just follow one route. But if you follow a bias, it invariably costs you quite a lot of money and time, because that bias might not be the one that's leading to your animal welfare problem. Once you get a failure to achieve results, i.e. you don't find out what's having an impact and why this problem is occurring, you invariably have a confirmation of your bias, because there's a tendency in human nature that we don't want to admit that now that we've spent $5,000 and 4 months, that actually we got it wrong. So maybe there's just a couple more tests we could do. Maybe we just need to spend a little bit more time. And invariably, it rolls out that you can spend a huge amount of time and a huge amount of money just pursuing one route. Whereas in actual fact, what's most likely is that there are several factors which are leading to this problem, or even more complicated and annoyingly, and not at all good for sort of nice practical applied zoo situations, they're probably all related to each other. However, this is not insurmountable, is my, hopefully my take-home message. And this is where a lot of the stuff that Kathy was talking to us about in terms of the Elephant Project, I'm going to try and dumb down without a huge grant and lots of money, and try and think on a very much case-by-case scenario. So in terms of, we know that we might all come to animal welfare problems with a certain bias, and we have an interest and we have an inclination to think that that problem may derive from one particular factor. What we can do is maybe think, right, okay, if we think with a big blank bit of paper, what are all of the different factors that might lead to behavioural problems in zoos? We can then start ticking them off and say, right, okay, we've spent 3 weeks gathering this information, 3 weeks gathering this information, and you can make sure that you get a very small amount of information on many different factors to make sure that you haven't missed out something. So the first area that one can look at, or at least one area that can generate factors which may lead to behavioural problems, are very specific factors which may or may not be in captivity, which animals may or may not have in the wild. So what are those specific differences? I am a great believer that there's a continuum between wild and captivity, but there are also very specific factors that might be different. And these involve the environment, they involve humans, and they involve nutrition. Happily, many of these things have been covered in talks prior to this. And so in terms of the environment, we might be thinking about the broad physical environment the animal lives in. So in terms of the local area, it can be things like climate and latitude and day length. And these are frequently overlooked in terms of having impacts on the animals that we work with, because to a large extent we feel there's no impact that we can have on them. So frequently we don't necessarily look at them. There's the immediate physical environment, so the housing that the animal is in. And again, lots of these factors have all been covered before. There's a fabulous review paper in Applied Animal Behaviour Science. There was a very good special issue back in 2007. And there are a whole variety of factors associated with the immediate physical environment, which, because they are routine, we forget that they are having an impact on the animals that we're working with. The video isn't really necessary, but it's just a bit of a boring talk otherwise, because there's just lots of chatting and not enough pretty pictures. But this is just one of those examples. I like having data to back up what I say. I've taken out loads of data because it needs to be 15 minutes. But in terms of the factors that are going to have an impact on our animals and might be leading to animal welfare issues, the presence of visitors generates all sorts of impacts. One of them is noise. This was a great study that was done at Dublin Zoo. And in the graph here, these are the numbers of aggressive acts. And this is how noisy the visitor area was here. Now, to a large extent, we usually go, oh, yeah, it's really busy and noisy. But, oh, look, there's really, really thick glass, and surely the noise doesn't transfer that much. In this enclosure here, we've got a silverback gorilla and a family group, and the male gorilla acted very aggressively when we had very, very high noise levels. This, once it was established, was mitigated really easily, not by not letting visitors in the house, which I'm sure the keepers were very keen on, but putting a thick flooring substrate here, turning the lights down, putting cargo netting everywhere. And those are really, really easy things to implement, which strangely, the minute an area is darker, visitors tend to be a lot quieter. And so that can be a very, very easy way to dampen down noise, actually getting the visitors to just be less noisy. Humans, Jeff spoke about this, a lot of other people have as well, are a major part of our animals' lives in zoos. Keepers, there is such a scant amount of data on the impact our keepers are having on animals and on welfare. And yet, if we think about it, there are lots and lots of different ways that they could be affecting welfare, both in a positive or, as the context of this paper, potentially in a negative way. Certainly, Jeff has gone through the model that he proposed in terms of how fear and previous experience with people might have an impact. There is a lot of evidence about how there could be correlations between negative relations with keepers and animal welfare problems. There's also a lot of types of interactions that we're having with our animals. When we're training them, when we're feeding them, when we're sort of ignoring them because we're just walking past, there's lots and lots of ways in which keepers are having an impact on the animals that we're working with. And visitors is a situation which we have got data on and has been spoken about earlier today. And certainly for quite a few of the primates, visitors can have a stressful impact. Now, this is a fairly counterintuitive study. And I'm trying to make the video work. Here we go. So this was a study that we did at Paignton. There are very few studies that have actually collected data of the impact of training outside of the training event. So there is a lovely amount of data demonstrating that training can achieve its initial goals of changing animal behaviour. And what we don't see so much of is seeing whether the act of having a training programme has an effect on activity budgets, on interactions between animals in the group, or in fact on interactions with visitors. Now, this is just a little snippet. Here we have the mean number of interactions initiated by colobus to keepers, and those are people in green. Staff, those are people in green, but they don't feed the colobus. And then we have public, anyone who doesn't wear green. I don't know if this is how the colobus differentiate, but that's how we differentiated. And what we see along here, this is the baseline. So these are the number of interactions the colobus initiated with these three groups of people before we started training. The first month after we started training, the second month, and then the third month. And as you can see, as the training program became more established, the colobus actually initiated far fewer interactions with any types of people at all. And so for some people who don't like the idea of training, that might be counterintuitive because they're worrying that it might lead animals to overly identify and interact with people. But in actual fact, for animals that do overly identify and interact with people, training or creating a training program could be really advantageous. Another area from the animal's environment, sort of outside of the animal, that we don't think about really nearly enough is nutrition and the impact that nutrition may have on animal welfare. I'm not sure that it's been touched on really very much in this meeting, but we talk very much about wild-type behaviours, the things that animals have adapted to do in terms of surviving in the wild. We don't talk about the fact that the nutritional composition of food that we feed most of our animals is really a really long way out of kilter to what they've adapted to. So it's really high in sugar, really low in fibre, and those types of things may be causing some of the animal welfare problems that we see. Certainly, a good friend of mine's done quite a lot of research on obesity in lemurs, and I think we're probably aware that there's obesity problems in quite a few zoo populations. Also, the way that we present the food may or may not lead to some of the animal welfare problems. One of the things that my boss, the head of our department, is always trying to get across is that whole food is a really good way to go. So we've done a lot of research demonstrating how whole food versus chopped food is, it doesn't lead to aggression. It actually reduces the likelihood of contamination. There's just a whole variety of reasons why giving whole food is preferential. And if anything, it also saves a hell of a lot of time because you're not having to chop the whole time. Then there's free food versus food that you can give them within enrichment, and also how many times a day do you feed them, and whether they actually have any control, whether that's predictable, and all of those elements may be factors leading to behavioural problems, or indeed they could alleviate behavioural problems. So now switching our focus to things within the animal, and thinking about whether the animal is functioning normally. So all of those things that I've addressed so far, those are factors outside of the animal which might be leading to problems. It might actually be an internal problem. The animal themselves may not be functioning properly. Now, the big issue we have, and you did the arms, we have this many species in zoos, and having a concept of what is normal is really tricky. And so when we say, go on then, physiological normal, behavioural normal, it's really, really difficult. But we can have a stab. We can certainly, in terms of keeping very good records, and this is where having an individual approach to animal welfare problems can be quite a good way of addressing this situation, is you can compare an animal with itself. Now, we all keep a huge number of records. I'm not sure how many of us actually go back and review those records systematically, because again, we have a lot of work on, we have a lot of animals, and invariably we're collecting a huge amount of data, because scientists like me say, oh, go on, can't you collect this, 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 and this? So to a certain extent, I was impressed with Kathy's, you know, having an external body that are sort of data crunching and managing some of that data, and maybe there are facilities within ZIMS and programs that are coming through that will enable us to much better manage a lot of the records that we're keeping, so that we can internally validate and look at individuals against themselves. From our first presentation, we heard about some of the ways that activity of the HBA access can help us, looking at cortisol, reproductive activity and longevity. All of those can be factors that we look at to establish how and why we might have some of these behavioural problems. Again, medical health is something which I suspect a lot of us would look at first for quite a long time, and this presentation hopefully will mean that we look at a lot of other things. This is, just because I like to put the data in to illustrate the point, this is a fabulous graph that was very opportunistically collected during the foot and mouth incident in the UK, where all the zoos were closed and then very slowly zoos started to open again. And this was actually collected at Chester Zoo. A friend of mine is doing his PhD on spider monkeys, which have a very, very high level of aggression. And so he was looking at all sorts of factors that might be leading to aggression in spider monkeys. Up here we have cortisol levels, and along here we have mean number of visitors. I can't wait to go home and say, oh, do you know what? Detroit get 18,000 just at the weekend, because that's such a huge number of visitors in our world. Anyway, so there is this really, really significant positive correlation with visitor number and aggression. As a rule, these types of analyses can't be done, because very rarely do we actually have instances where we have no visitors coming into the zoo. Or they're skewed because they're, you know, certain days in the week. But because this was a four-month period during which time there were no visitors, the data are very, very robust. Behaviour. Behaviour is something that lots of people have spoken about, and so I'll go over it quite quickly. Certainly we can do comparisons against wild, depending on how you choose your wild and making sure that it's representative of good habitat, represents several different groups. Behavioural flexibility, again, how whether your animals have very diverse numbers of behaviours in their activity budget, whether they're able to adapt to new situations, and group composition. Now, with I have to get Sulawesi macaques in. These are just the best. And then gibbons. And this is one of my wild guys that obviously really likes water sports. And one of the things that I first got very interested in were these wild captive comparisons, which is why I guess I get very particular about what do we call wild and how many types of groups do we need to have a good representation of wild. So here we have the amount of time spent performing a behavior. We have social, moving, resting, foraging, and feeding. And there are eight groups that make up our captive column, and there are three groups that make up our wild column. And there is no statistically significant difference between these two activity budgets, principally because the variation in the wild is so huge. And so certainly there seems to be a tendency for there to be less resting in the wild and more resting in captivity, but the wild groups are so huge in their difference to each other that actually there is no significant difference. So if on activity budget alone we tried to determine whether the welfare was good or bad, we'd say that the macaques are doing fine. This is why maybe there are more measures. This has been mentioned as well, individual differences. Certainly the study of personality is now something which, you know, you won't get shot at dawn that you suggest that you're not allowed, you know, that you just study a population. But we now are very happily, I'd say, recognize individual differences. Certainly for a long time, people recognize age and sex as factors that might have an impact on welfare. Geriatric conditions, I think, are something that we haven't really broached very well at all within the zoo world, because for a long time we've considered longevity to be such a gold standard of we've achieved what we wanted because they're still alive. But geriatric care is certainly something we need to address. Previous history and life experience are things which, again, these records that all of our keepers are keeping that should follow the animals as they're being transferred are things we can come back to if we see behavioural problems. And then certainly if we have rearing history, then we can also hopefully have stuff on their development. This was just a very quick snapshot from some of Sue Margulies' work on sort of showing how animals change as they get older. And really, it was just an illustration of how geriatric animals can vary significantly from their younger counterparts in terms of, and this is just a representation of fertility. So that is a very, very quick whistle-stop tour, really trying to identify the whole variety of factors that are going to have an impact on our animals and could, vis-a-vis, be the reason why we see an animal welfare problem. So when someone comes to you and says, you know, our gorillas, you know, grooming its, you know, its feet so much and it's actually chewed off a digit, and you go, ah, I'll do a biopsy, it must be a skin problem. And then 5 months down the line, it's still over-grooming. We can avoid those types of situations by saying, right, okay, there is a problem. Have we checked out? Do we know very much about the environment? Do we know very much about that individual? Do we know very much about the behaviour? And we can hopefully go around the whole cycle of information to make sure that we've got some information on all of those factors that might have an impact. And finally, and I sort of alluded to this in the panel discussion, sometimes there isn't the problem. So I used this model to address an animal welfare problem that we had in our Sulawesi macaque group at Paignton. We'd had chronic diarrhea for 10 years. It's fairly chronic. And so I had a student in 4 months do every sort of behavioural data collection that we could. We went through 10 years of data. We looked at diets. We looked at everything you can think of. And then when we could find no pattern at all, we then said, right, okay, we're going to spend 6 months looking at voided poo. I have poo students and I feel sorry for them. And so they're staring at the bottoms of all these macaques and seeing who's pooing what, where and when and what's the consistency. And there was no problem. There was no problem. You have a large enough group of primates who have all sorts of stresses going on in their lives, and occasionally you'll get diarrhea. and add that to a not so systematic way of approaching things, and all of a sudden it feels like there's this chronic problem because didn't they have diarrhea 2 months ago? Yep, we've definitely got a problem. So sometimes we're not necessarily being systematic in the way that we identify what is a problem. And so that too is something we need to do. I'd like to thank Cynthia, her team, Laurie, Elizabeth, lovely to meet Ron. The zoo has been fabulous to us. And so thank you very, very much for listening, and hopefully there'll be time for discussion with you all in the next break. So thank you all very much.